Okay, to this full house, I'm going to give a lecture on the gravitational action. So I understand that you've met, at least you've met the Einstein-Hilbert action and discussed it, but not necessarily delved into its use in terms of an Euler-Lagrange approach to calculating the Einstein equations. So in terms of getting the Einstein-Hilbert action, if we just think, you know, normally about how we might build up our general Lagrangian or general action, usually it goes through more of an Euler-Lagrange process where we've got a Lagrangian, which might be a sort of kinetic minus potential type of structure. So with gravity, our observable is the metric, and yet if we think about first derivatives of the metric, the only sort of object we've got is the connection, and that's not a tensor. So it's, at least for our standard Einstein gravity, it's very unclear how we might write down the action in terms of a normal kinetic minus potential piece. However, if we think about integrating a sort of density function over our space, so our volume element is this root g d4x. Then we do have an obvious scalar to try, which is the Ricci scalar. So what you see when you do the variation of this action, which again I'm kind of assuming you did, when you vary the action, you get sort of three obvious pieces. First of all, you vary the Ricci scalar, and so that gives you the Ricci tensor times the variation of the inverse metric. And then you've got a piece that looks like the variation of the Ricci tensor contracted. And then you've also got to take the variation of the square root of the determinant, which again, I believe you saw would be minus a half g delta g inverse. So the first line is good because that's the Einstein tensor. So this is what we want. But then things start to get a little bit more interesting when we look at that final piece, the delta RAB. So here, we have from the Palatini lemma that the variation of the Ricci tensor is given in terms of derivatives of variations of the connection. And so while the connection itself is not a tensor, differences between connections is a tensor. So this is indeed a tensorial expression. So it's a geometric expression done in this abstract index notation. And then when we input what this is, which again, I'm assuming this is more of a refresher, So when you look at what the variation of the connection is, it's just given again in terms of derivatives of the variation of the metric. So let me just check you've seen that in the first GR course. No, yes, no.
I don't think you've seen the explicit form of delta.
So if you want, so I'll just indicate how you derive something like this. So the quickest and easiest way to derive the expression, say, for delta gamma is to use a set of coordinates which are called normal coordinates. And these are, in essence, the local inertial frame coordinates. So in other words, delta, or rather, the first derivative of the metric is zero, but not the second. So that's just saying that you're choosing a local frame which is sort of got no connection. So it's kind of flat. But it's obviously, if you're in a general manifold, space-time is curved. You can't gauge that away. So it means that the second derivative of the metric doesn't vanish, but the first does. So it's like taking the first term in a Taylor series. It's like sort of taking a tangent. So if your curve curves, then that gradient will only be a leading order approximation to the change in your function. And so, you know, it's like, yeah, it's that sort of idea. And so if you look at gamma ABC, and then you say, what happens if I vary it? Well, this term inside here is equal to zero to leading order in these normal coordinates, right? So if I take delta of this whole expression, let me do it in a different color so it's kind of clearer what I'm doing. So delta gamma, if I were to take the delta G inverse out here, I would just be multiplying it by something zero. So obviously that's not worth doing. So when I take the delta, what I get is just the variation of all those g's inside the bracket. So here, I also, when I do my variational principle, I want to have delta g inverse and not delta g. So this becomes, well, let me first make it covariant. Okay, so this is my expression for the variation of the connection, but now that's not a true in all coordinate systems. But in the normal coordinate system, this is equal to a half GAD grad C delta G BD plus grad B delta G CD minus grad D delta G BC. So because all of the components of the connection vanish in that coordinate system, I can replace the partial derivatives by covariant derivatives. But now I've got an expression that is true in all frames. This is now geometric. So this expression is true in all the frames. And so I then convert my delta G's to delta G inverses at the price of a minus sign. And then I take another derivative over here and you get this expression. So you can sort of You might not see it straight, but you can see that it's plausible. So, if I look back to the variation of my Einstein-Hilbert action, my delta RAB GAB term now contains total derivatives. So the first bit is the bit that I wanted, and then I get a second piece. So I can use just a sort of shorthand for taking a divergence. A covariant divergence is just 1 over root g times partial derivatives of root g of the vector. And so if you look here, this here is a vector because I'm contracting on that index. And here, this is also a divergence term. So this last term So when I integrate by parts, this is a total derivative, so all I get is a boundary term. So here my integral is over some boundary, which might be a sort of natural boundary, it might be something that I have sort of decided to truncate my space-time, as we'll see later. And NA is, of course, the normal to the boundary. Now, I think in that particular example, that's an outward pointing normal. Okay, so when you first meet the Einstein-Hilbert action and you do this variation, you kind of look at that expression there on the top right-hand side and say, well, I've got my Einstein equations, that's great. The boundary term doesn't look like what I normally have, but let's sort of sweep that under the carpet for the moment. And so that's how you say this is the gravitational action. And that's kind of fine if all you're doing is sort of standard general relativity. But if you start to think about trying to sort of take gravity moving towards a more quantum gravity type of description, what you might want to do is to start taking some sort of path integral. And typically that is something like, you know, a sort of integration over, well, paths, in this case, manifolds, some sort of e to the is on h bar or something like that. So your action ought to be encoding the physics about your manifold. However, if you think about it, I've got a whole set of solutions Schwarzschild for any mass, Kerr for any mass or, and most rotations, all of which are Ricci flat. Therefore, all of them, according to the Einstein-Hilbert action, have zero action. So how can it make sense to have a whole set of different physical solutions, all with the same action, and on top of that with zero action? So it seems like this is not really a very helpful way to start thinking about whether or not it even makes sense to take some sort of partition function type of approach to gravity. So this and other things led Gary Gibbons and Stephen Hawking to take a second look at what was going on with the gravitational action. And in looking at that sort of right-hand segment, you kind of notice that if you ignore that boundary term, that's not quite working by the rules of the Euler-Lagrange game. Euler-Lagrange tells you that you vary your trajectory, but with fixed endpoints. So your field, delta phi, is zero at the boundary. Here, if I set delta g to zero at the boundary, there's absolutely no guarantee that these normal derivatives of g are also going to be zero. And indeed, the previous decade to the Gibbons-Hawking paper, Werner Israel had derived a set of equations which hypersurfaces satisfied. So his interest was in thinking about dust or dust in the, in cosmology, and sort of thinking about, well, can we, if we have a sort of sheet or approximately a sheet of matter, how does that gravitate? And he had derived equations for this surface by sort of taking a zero thickness limit. And he used that Gauss-Kadatze formalism and thought about the extrinsic curvature of the sheet and related that to the space-time curvature. So there was, a sense in which there was already some familiarity with this idea of thinking about boundaries as potentially being, possibly being dynamical, but certainly having some sort of properties, and that had something to do with extrinsic curvature. So let's just dig a little bit further into this boundary term. So what I want to do is I want to think about the boundary and think about maybe the boundary as having some sort of physics, possibly an action of its own. And so therefore I'm going to go back to what we did a week ago, which was the Gauss-Kadatze formalism. So let's look at the boundary. So here, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look at what those expressions might be. I want to sort of say, I'm okay about taking a delta g to zero, but I want to know what these normal derivatives could potentially be. So I'm going to work in the so-called Gaussian normal gauge. And so what that means is that I look at my surface. So here, this gauge is where I've got my surface. So we're going back to thinking about Gauss-Kadatze again. I've got my surface, I've got my normal, and I integrate up my normal field geodesically. So in other words, at a given point on this integral curve, I sort of define Z to be the integral of the proper distance from sigma. So you can think of that really as extending sigma away from its original location, and so you extend it by its a proper distance function z. So you can always do this locally, and that's all we really care about. And what it means is that the normal n, which is d by dz in these coordinates, has nz is 1 and n downstairs is minus 1. And n remains d by dz under variations. So in other words, all of the variation, everything, is sort of wrapped up in this part. So delta GAB is delta HAB. And H is the first fundamental form. So the extrinsic curvature of this surface is just encoded. This is now very directly showing how the extrinsic curvature is encoded in the connection. So again, this is in the Gaussian normal gauge. So now I want to just think a little bit about what happens if I vary things either on or close to the boundary. So delta K So I just write down in this, this is just the sort of covariant expression, if you like, of delta k. Although in this coordinate system, my n doesn't change. But, you know, once I've written down a covariant expression, that is true in any frame. And so this, because the only component of delta G, or the only components of delta G, are parallel to the surface, n dot delta G is zero. So these first two terms I can sort of integrate up to get just some an extrinsic curvature times delta G and a normal derivative of delta G. Now this is delta G, not delta G inverse. So I can just take the trace of that delta KAB, and then you see that you get K contracted with delta G, which is minus K contracted with delta G inverse. And the last term I've also turned into a delta G inverse. So now that expression is is covariant. I suppose I could put an H there as well. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to get this expression and kind of rework it into something where I don't have any more derivatives of delta G, and I've got things that are properties of the boundary itself. And so just looking at the other term, so once again, I'm using this Gaussian normal property. I'm first of all pulling the n inside the derivative, and I notice then that this vanishes because I have said that n is just a constant, therefore the only components of delta GAB are lying parallel to the surface. And so what I've now done is I've turned if I look at that expression, I've got the first term, this term I can relate to a delta G and some extra variation. And the other term I can also relate to something just involving delta G. So now it looks like I'm going to be able to rewrite that last term in a format that is now going to be compliant with Euler-Lagrange. So if I now take KAB delta HAB plus HAB delta KB, then that is minus a half grad n of delta G inverse, or the trace of delta G inverse. That's from rewriting that first one. Yep.
Could you explain why sometimes you have to write G inverse? Because usually you can just raise the indices, right? And that's G inverse.
Right, but in that sense, if you remember that your definition of inverse, right, is that GAB, GBC is delta AC, right? And so therefore, if I take a variation of that, the variation of the right-hand side is zero because delta is just one or zero. And so that tells me that delta G, G inverse plus G delta G inverse is zero. So, you know, it's not just delta G inverse is not just raising the indices on delta G. Yeah? And so when we do the variation of the action, because our Einstein equations are covariant, downstairs indices, that's why we vary with respect to the inverse metric. And of course, implicit in that is that your manifold is non-singular and your metric is invertible. And indeed, physically, it has to be, because if the metric was not invertible, that would mean that there was a sort of nilpotent part, which would mean that there was sort of a direction in which there was no distance, right? So we physically, at least as long as we're not in like at a singularity or something, physically, our space-time, one of our suppositions is our space-time is locally looks like an inertial frame, which means we can invert the metric locally. So it's the same information, you know, that delta G inverse there, you know, is carrying, you can see it's sort of carrying the same information, but in some sense it's sort of, you know, the inverse or the minus part. So, yeah. So, I mean, I suppose here I should be literal and say it's delta G inverse, but typically when both indices are upstairs, that's sort of an indicator that it is indeed delta G inverse.
On the same topic.
Yeah.
Sometimes you write delta J inverse minus 1 cc when an object...
And sometimes I don't.
And sometimes you don't, yeah. Is there between you?
I'm just being lazy.
Okay, okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's just the trace.
Okay.
So... I guess it's the difference between when you're doing a calculation yourself or trying to explain it. So I guess in this discussion, I'm kind of starting on at both ends, if you like, of where I want to be and meeting in the middle, in the sense that I've flagged that issue with doing Euler-Lagrange and the Einstein-Hilbert action, and then I've stepped back and I'm starting now to play with the Gauss-Kadatze formalism and thinking of sigma as some sort of hypersurface in the manifold. But at the same time, I've sort of got half an eye on that boundary term. So looking at all that I've written down from the perspective of sigma as a hypersurface, I deduce that if I take a variation of k root h, I get the normal derivative of the trace of my inverse metric variation. And then this second piece is just coming from varying root h. So... putting it together, my grad n of delta G inverse putting all those pieces together, I can rewrite that boundary term up at the top there in terms of a variation of something that lives on the boundary plus some extra term that now multiplies delta HAB, which is, of course, the same as delta GAB in this coordinate system. So I've now turned that boundary term into something that I can legitimately ignore. If I consider now the variation I add to my gravitational action, And then when I vary that whole action, what I get so if I add this extra term to the action and then take the variation, varying that k root h term absorbs this boundary piece that was left over from the variation of the Einstein action, but it leaves that final term. And so here, if we're just interested in bulk Einstein gravity, I've now got an action where my Euler-Lagrange methodology is completely secure. I've rewritten everything so that when I take the variation, I get my bulk Einstein equations, I get a boundary term that becomes zero when I set delta G equals zero on the boundary. But just as an aside, what this now allows us to do is to think of the boundary itself as a physical dynamical object. So we could start to add additional actions on the boundary, some sort of matter action, and then we would have a separate set of equations for the boundary. So just as an example, which I'll just, I'm not going to pick this up too much, I might add an extra term that looks something like a cosmological constant on the boundary, for example. And then if I were to vary that, that would give me It would give me minus a half sigma HAB delta HAB. And so now you could see that that might start to give you a relation between the extrinsic curvatures and this sort of constant energy, vacuum energy on the brain. And so that would give you additional dynamical equations of motion. So we kind of saw this when I was talking about those domain walls. You can either think of them from a fully four-dimensional or bulk perspective and sort of take a zero thickness limit, or you can actually use this boundary approach, in which case you start to see a sort of relation between extrinsic curvatures and the local energy momentum. Okay, so let's see this in action, and I'm going to look at the Schwarzschild black hole, but I'm going to send T goes to I tau, so I'm going to analytically continue. So actually, what I'm doing here now is taking you along the path that Gibbons and Hawking originally took. So they really started actually at this point. And it was about thinking, well, if we're going to start moving towards quantum gravity, we're going to want to sort of think about this gravitational action. Let's look at these Euclidean metrics. And what they noticed is a very interesting property of this Euclidean space. So out at infinity, you've just got, if you've got big spheres, but from the perspective of tau and r, you've just got something that looks flat, d tau squared plus dr squared. But as r goes to 2gm, you've now got what looks like a singular point. However, as r goes to 2gm, if you kind of look at how this is blowing up like r minus 2gm. So dr, if I think about what is the proper distance from 2gm, it's dr over the square root of r minus 2gm. And that I can say is d of the square root of r minus 2gm. And so from the radial perspective, by just changing what I mean by radial coordinate, it doesn't look that bad. And then if the square root of r minus 2gm is a new radial coordinate, then the thing multiplying d tau squared becomes the square of that new radial coordinate. And that really doesn't look that bad. So let's try and track that through a little bit more precisely. I've just given you the sort of hand-waving discussion there. Let me say I'm looking for a radial coordinate that's proportional to the square root of r minus 2gm. So then I look at 2 rho d rho, and that is lambda dr. So that means that 4 lambda r minus 2gm d rho squared equals lambda squared dr squared. So really, I'm just looking at for the constant of proportionality, so that some lambdas cancel there. And so dr squared over r minus 2gm times 2gm. So that is what the radial part of the metric looks like. So that relates to my d rho squared. Therefore, lambda is 8gm. And rho is proper distance. Okay, now let's look at the tau piece. So this looks like, well, r minus 2gm is rho squared on lambda, so that's rho squared on 8gm. And then that's divided by r, so that's divided by another 2gm, d tau squared, which is rho squared d of tau over 4gm squared. So 2gm looks like the origin of r squared in polar coordinates. So it looks like the origin, provided we identify our Euclidean time periodically with a given periodicity that depends on the mass of the black hole. So they must have been really excited when they found this, because periodic time in field theory is the indicator of field theory at a finite temperature. So you get, which here is 1 over 8 pi gm, you get the temperature of the black hole, which they just, Hawking had just calculated sort of 3 or 4 years previously, to be 1 over 8 pi gm. And so here was a completely different way of looking at the black hole, but giving you the same answer. So that's, and in fact, in practice, when we want to calculate the temperature of a black hole, this is the method that we use. So I'm just added in the constants if you are interested in what it actually is. So if I now try to sketch the geometry of this Euclidean section at large r, looking at tau r, at large r I've just got a cylinder of constant radius. So I guess that radius is beta. And then as I come into the origin, so this is tau, this is r, this cylinder smooths off quite neatly at 2gm. So that is the Euclidean geometry of the black hole. And I guess because it was two blokes discovering it, they called it a cigar. Okay, so that's looked at that Euclidean geometry of the Schwarzschild black hole. So what does that mean for computing the action? So let's now compute the action. So again, I've already said that the Einstein-Hilbert part of the action is zero, so that doesn't really help us. So now we have to compute the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. So what I do is I take the black hole cigar and I truncate it at some large r, let's say, some finite but large r. So I add boundary. So my metric on the boundary is just taken by looking at the Euclidean metric and deleting the dr squared piece. And my normal is an inward pointing normal. There's always some confusion over the sign of the normal, and I quite often get it wrong first time, so I just proceed and then check with some example spacetimes that I know. But technically, with the sign I put for the Gibbons-Hawking term, it's an inward pointing normal. Okay, so the curvature of that boundary, which is the divergence of n, so that's 1 over r squared dr r squared nr. So that looks like 2 over r Okay, and then square root of h is equal to the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r, r squared sine theta. So that when I take k root h, so my first term, I multiply those two square roots together. So that's 1 minus 2gm on r. So that's the first piece. And then the second piece just gives me a gm. It should be gm on r, so I'm wondering where I've... Squared. It's r squared. Okay, so that's what I get for my boundary term, and then I have to integrate it up. But you see, when you integrate it up over this surface here at fixed r, all you just get is a 4 pi beta. So in other words, I've got a divergent boundary term. So that's a little bit troubling. However, it looks like it would be divergent even if I set the mass to zero. So let's look at what happens to flat space. So flat space at periodicity, I'm now going to say it's not necessarily the same. So my boundary term now is going to look like this. Therefore, my k naught is minus 2 on r. My h naught is r squared sine theta. And therefore, the integral of k naught root h naught is minus 4 pi beta naught times 2r. So that's also divergent. So what this tells us is that we need to renormalize our action by doing some sort of background subtraction. So in other words, we want to subtract the action of flat space, but typical, not done a good job here, let's do it again. So in order to do a proper background subtraction, I have to subtract the action of flat space with exactly the same boundary. So if you like, I'm taking a cylinder and sliding it over until the boundaries are the same. I then compute the gravitational action of each, subtract the flat space one from the black hole one, and that should be my properly regularized answer. So here, notice that if I want to match at a finite r, what I'm essentially doing is I'm saying that d tau naught squared has to be the same as 1 minus 2gm on r d tau squared. And so beta naught is going to be root 1 minus 2gm on r beta. So in essence, you're matching the two spacetimes at the local temperature of the boundary. And so that means if I expand that square root, because r is assumed to be large, that gives me beta naught is roughly beta times 1 minus gm on r. So I pop that in here. And I get minus 4 pi beta into 2r minus 2gm. So if I now subtract these actions, I've got, where is it? Minus 4 pi beta 2r minus 3gm. And then I've got minus 4 pi beta 2r minus 2gm. So what I end up with is beta m on 2. So in other words, I have now successfully renormalized the gravitational action, and I have something that tracks the parameters of the solution, the mass m. And of course, remember that beta here is 1 over 8 pi gm. So just to sort of finish off and see, does this actually make sense? So again, this is like taking this, I suppose it's really taking the path integral, but we can sort of think of this in terms of our partition function. So rz, which is the trace of e to the minus beta h, rh is a sort of Hamiltonian or an integral. One over beta times the action. And so our partition function is going to look like trace of e to the minus a Euclidean action, and where, you know, you trace over geometries with the same sort of boundary conditions. So here, if we take this approach, our entropy sort of d by dt. So if I follow that calculation through, that gives me beta squared dm by d beta on 2 for Schwarzschild. But beta is just 1 proportional to 1 over m. Sorry, that's t. Beta is 8 pi gm. I was looking at that thinking that doesn't look right. So I get that my entropy is beta m on 2, which is 4 pi g m squared, which I can write as 4 pi times 2 g m all squared divided by 4 g, which is the area over 4 g, which was kind of what I claimed in the first place was the expression for the entropy. So when Gibbons and Hawking were doing that sort of the initial paper, I mean, they must have got super excited when they saw that Euclidean periodicity, the periodicity of Euclidean time. My suspicion is they first didn't do the background subtraction quite right, but then kept going, sort of thinking about how do I do this properly. In other words, doing the background subtraction with the manifolds being the same, and then getting this completely different way of deriving thermodynamics, which is, I would say, perhaps more legitimate from a quantum perspective, but giving the same answers. And I think this sort of almost perplexing, I think, approach, or the one of the perplexing things about black hole thermodynamics is that you often end up deriving the thermodynamic relations from a very classical perspective. You're looking at what happens in families of black hole solutions. And yet, the quantities that you're deriving, like entropy or temperature, really are fundamentally quantum mechanical. You just don't see it because we usually set h bar to 1. And yet, using intuition from thermodynamics leads you back to results in classical general relativity. And so it's just one of these very bizarre things that, you know, really none of this ought to work, right? Because in fact, this path integral is just not defined. You can make deformations of your manifold that have arbitrarily sort of negative energy, and it really shouldn't work. And of course, we know that like this approach to quantum gravity doesn't really work, at least not in that format. And yet, it gives you so many results that you can get in different ways. And so that's kind of why people still use it or still do it. But it's a sort of pragmatic approach. It's saying, well, you know, we're cheating a little bit, but actually it works. And it's quite a powerful way of deriving things. So it's, I think it's just one of those curiosities.